Brothers, could we take our seats now and reconvene? We now move to the, again, to the Committee on Laity, Marriage, Family Life, and Youth. And Archbishop Chaput, this time, along with Bishop Caggiano, wants to deal with a report, an update on the implementation of the Synod for Youth, Christus Vincit.
Thank you very much, Your Eminence. And once again, brothers, thank you very much for your attention. Good afternoon. The Committee of Laity, Marriage, Family Life, and Youth is grateful for this second opportunity to share our thoughts with you today and to report on Pope Francis's recent apostolic exhortation, Christus Vivit. There's a beautiful publication that our conference has done. I hope you get a copy so that you'll have the opportunity to share with the young adults and youth of your own diocese. It has come to our attention that many Catholics, including many bishops, know very little about this document. Yesterday, we had a lengthy conversation on youth and young adults who have disaffiliated with the Catholic Church. Christus Vivit complements and in many respects responds to that dialogue, offering us a vision of hope going forward. Knowing more about this document also allows us to receive the magisterium of Pope Francis. Engaging with Christus Vivit can be a tangible sign of communion with the Holy Father in our pastoral work among young people. We wanted to take this moment to share some highlights of this important work. You will find a one-page overview in your packets. It's really quite attractive. Christus Vivit was released by Pope Francis this spring. It is his post-synodal exhortation following the synod that took place in Rome in October 2018 on young people, the faith, and vocational discernment. I myself was one of the 9 U.S. bishops who served as your delegates. Christus Vivit is written in a letter format, aimed first to young people, who were defined as those 16 to 30 years old, who we call youth and young adults. This is a very diverse group of young men and women that includes adolescents, college students, and young adults in their 20s and 30s of all cultures, races, and backgrounds. It is important to note these age groups are distinct and each have their own pastoral needs. The document is also addressed to the entire people of God, including you and me, and the pastors and pastoral leaders of our church. As the exhortation's title suggests, Christ, eternally young, is our starting point. Pope Francis begins with this beautiful and firm declaration. These are his words. Christ is alive. He is our hope. And in a wonderful way, he brings youthfulness to our world, and everything he touches becomes young, full of life. He is in you, he is with you, and never abandons you. When you feel you are growing old out of sorrow, resentment, or fear, doubt, or failure, he will always be there to restore your strength and your hope. Those are beautiful words, aren't they? My brothers, in challenging times like this, and when many feel uncertainty on how to proceed with young people, we are blessed to hear this message of hope. The Holy Father also points to young people as our hope. And echoing this sentiment, with your permission, we have invited 2 young people here on the stage, Brenda Noriega and Brian Rooley, to share their insights on Christus Vivit with us. They represented the United States at an international post-synod forum with Pope Francis this summer. First, I would like to welcome Ms. Brenda Noriega from the Diocese of San Bernardino. Brenda, the stage is yours.
Thank you, Archbishop Papu, and thank you, bishops. As a young person ministering with and to my peers, let me say how grateful I am to Pope Francis for Christus Vivit. It is a blessing to have this exhortation in our church today. For those of us who minister to young people, it's a kairos, laying a new foundation for our work. The 9 chapters of the document follow the Latin American methodology to see, discern, enact pastoral model. I think that in the United States, we tend to see and react. And Christus Vivit asks us to pause and discern before jumping in. Christus Vivit asks us to listen more patiently and attentively to youth and young adults. Pope Francis invites us to pay attention to the struggles and suffering of young people. He says, "May the church never fail to weep before the tragedies of the young. May we never become inured to them." Christus Vivit lays out some areas that are especially important to encounter, including young people impacted by marginalization and poverty, young people feeling overwhelmed by culture, family, or judgment, young migrants and refugees and immigrants, and those impacted by DACA, young people being bullied or ostracized online, young people who feel unloved, youth or young adults experiencing or witnessing abuse in all forms. By sharing his observations from the synodal consultation process, Pope Francis is also asking us to reframe our ministries with young people. He is inviting us to more intentionally emphasize and prioritize pastoral care and accompaniment. In our families, and through the transitions and difficulties faced in youth and young adulthood. One of my favorite chapters is chapter 4, which is Pope Francis' pastoral response to the frustrations faced by young people. I like to call this chapter the chapter of hope. In a kind and loving way, the Holy Father reminds youth and young adults of 3 truths. First, that God loves them, that young people are not worthless, that they matter to God, and because of that, they should matter to us. Second, that Jesus suffers alongside and saves them through the cross, reminding them that they are not alone. Jesus walks with them, and we are called to do the same. Third, that Christ is alive, that there is hope. He does not want us to be caught up in the negative statistics, but wants us to find grace and hope and light in all young people, regardless of their engagement or disengagement with the church. I myself find hope in the young people who are raising their voices about the environment, human dignity, and injustices, reminding us that prayers are always accompanied by actions. I also find hope when I see you, our pastors, willing to listen to us, to teach us and accompany us on the journey like spiritual fathers. And for that, I thank you. Now, my fellow forum delegate, Brian Root, from the Catholic Apostolate Center, and a student at Catholic University of America in Washington, will also share his insights about this document. Please welcome Brian Root.
Thank you, Brenda, and thank you, bishops. It's an honor to be here with you all today to engage in this dialogue. The Holy Father reminds us that as we walk on our journey with God, that we will meet obstacles, roadblocks, and even opposition, but that we are, as Christians, marked by the hope that comes only from God. for us to have this hope and to make this journey, Pope Francis echoes Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI's call in Deus Caritas Est for a deep and personal encounter with the risen Christ that is made manifest, among other ways, through our deep and personal relationships with others. A significant point that I would like to raise is that of spiritual accompaniment that has permeated the pontificate of Pope Francis. He introduced the practice in Evangelii Gaudium, gave it a very poignant symbolic image of a field hospital in Amoris Laetitia, and now reminds us how vital it is for ministry to youth and young adults. I myself would not be here before you if it were not for good and faithful Catholics who accompanied me. I was confirmed just a few years ago in the Diocese of Providence and had great accompaniment from high school campus ministers at St. Vincent Pallotti High School in Laurel, Maryland, from the religious education staff at St. Paul Catholic Church in Cranston, Rhode Island, and the continued accompaniment of my friends and pastoral leaders at the Catholic University of America. Accompaniment, when following the Emmaus model that Pope Francis uses, listens and creates sensitivity directed to the individual. It cultivates a sensitivity that is marked by discernment and allows both the accompanier and the one accompanied to perceive what is driving their journey to a deeper relationship and friendship with Christ, in which they witness what he has done for us, and they are messengers of that love to the world. It was once I myself had encountered Christ that I could go out into the world to care for the poor, to be an active member of our society, and to be an evangelizer. This is the missionary call that all of the baptized have received. In Christus Vivit, Pope Francis uses a word that's a bit unfamiliar to our English lexicon. He asks us, the young people, to be protagonists, or protagonisti in the Italian. One of the most important quotes from the document can be found in chapter 6, where the Holy Father reminds us, quote, "Today, in fact, we see a tendency to homogenize young people, blurring what is distinctive about their origins and backgrounds and turning them into a new line of malleable goods," number 186. We're warned against this homogenization that looks broadly at young people as those young people and assumes that all local, ethnic, racial, cultural, linguistic, and socioeconomic realities are the same, and that is dangerous. Chapter 7 is titled Youth Ministry, though, as Brenda has often reminded us, its more apt translation is Ministry to and with Youth and Young Adults. In this, Pope Francis reminds us that our ministry must be synodal, in that it invites and walks with young people, giving them the occasions, quote, for conversing, celebrating, singing, listening to real stories, and experiencing a shared encounter with the living God, number 204. In this, we can cultivate an organic, perhaps even sometimes messy, encounter with youth and young adults. In chapter 8, Pope Francis so beautifully writes, quote, "The salvation that God offers us is an invitation to be part of a love story. Interwoven with our personal stories, it is alive and wants to be born in our midst so that we can bear fruit just as we are, wherever we are, and with everyone all around us." Paragraph 252. Our individual stories do not occur in a vacuum. It is only when we come to know the stories of our brothers and sisters in Christ that we form the greater story that God is writing. Thank you for this opportunity to share our thoughts and reflections on Christus Vivit.
Brothers, allow me to conclude our presentation first and foremost by thanking you, Brenda, and you, Brian, for your presence here today, for your leadership, for ministering to other young people. Your presence here gives us great encouragement and hope. So thank you both. Thank you. Brothers, Christus Vivit is a call to action for everyone in the life of the church, regardless of our age. Our Holy Father calls our young people to step up and, quote, make a ruckus, find their place in leadership. He invites those of us who are older to rediscover our own youthfulness And the joy of that youthfulness that is rooted in enduring hope. He challenges everyone in leadership to invest more in youth and young adults. And for those of us who share the Episcopal ministry, he asks us to walk with and learn from young people. This call to action is really a moment of grace that allow me to say bluntly, a moment of grace that we should not and cannot allow to slip away. I know I speak for all of us here on how inspired and grateful we all are for the many women and men who have taken up ministry and walk daily with young people and young adults in our parishes and schools and dioceses around the country, often with limited resources. Our Holy Father expresses that same gratitude with this quote from Christus Vivit, 99th chapter. And I draw your attention to this one line: their efforts are like a great forest that quietly grows, a forest that is enduring, that is life-giving, that works quietly. So allow me to offer 4 points for our common discussion and for our enduring reflection. First, for those of us in leadership, I ask that we all take the time to read Christus Vivit from cover to cover and engage in dialogue with our co-workers in the vineyard, our priests and deacons, our religious women and men and lay leaders in our diocese, to dialogue with them and open up the richness of this document to enrich our ministries. Secondly, we who have the privilege to live here in the United States are aptly and uniquely able to receive this exhortation because we already have a large infrastructure of varying organizations filled with professional, dedicated, and creative people who are already ministering to young people and young adults. We, as bishops, are being asked to invest and learn in those services and organizations already at our service. These are just some of the ones we're familiar with: the National Federation for Catholic Youth Ministry that serves our teenagers and adolescents, LARED, which works with our Hispanic and Latino young people, the Catholic Campus Ministry Association, which works with our students in colleges and universities around the country, the National Advisory Team for Young Adult Ministry that particularly supports our ministries with those who are in their 20s and 30s, and of course the National Dialogue, which is a collaborative initiative which brings all of these organizations together in a spirit of synodality. You and I have the opportunity to learn more about these organizations and to support them. Because while all ministry is most effective at the local level, nonetheless, on the national level, they can help us all. Thirdly, some of the work, perhaps a great deal of the work being asked of us in Christus Vivit already is underway. For we must stop to celebrate all of the good work already being done in our families, in parishes, and schools. Taking a cue from the hopeful spirit that imbues this document, it is the spirit of Pope Francis. We must take the time to discover, learn, and share as best practices those initiatives already bearing great fruit. In any time of challenge, we may be tempted to immediately see solely the problems before us, or how we have fallen short, perhaps in our ministry with young people and young adults. But we must also celebrate what is already working and allow it to bear even greater fruit to enrich our ministry with young people, and you and I as brother bishops to promote those efforts. But lastly, the challenges remain, challenges endure. And so perhaps allow me to suggest that among those challenges, you and I need to find ways to encourage and accompany our pastors in advancing and investing in the ministry with youth and young adults in a time when perhaps many clerics shy away from ministry with young people and young adults. This is the time when you and I can walk with them as they walk with young people in this moment of grace. There is also the challenge for all of us to recognize that ministry to young people and young adults is one of great diversity: cultural, generational, vocational, developmental. And quite frankly, our ministry will not reach its goal unless every young person is at the table, particularly those who are immigrants, marginalized, and poor. As the Encuentro process has taught us, we must also develop our ministries both in English and Spanish for our young people. The National Dialogue reminds us and challenges us that ministry to young people and young adults are complementary but not the same thing. And Christus Vivit tells us that when we speak of vocations, as important as it is to foster vocations to priesthood, diaconate, and consecrated life, so too does it speak powerfully, beautifully, eloquently of vocations to married life and for single men and women who seek to live their baptismal call to holiness in concrete and effective ways in their lives. And lastly, and perhaps most importantly, our Holy Father challenges us to listen more deeply. For we do a lot of talking about young people and young adults. But Pope Francis is asking us in the heart to listen to and learn from them and invite them right now into appropriate leadership in the church. So to conclude, there is much for you and I and all of us to reflect on this remarkable document from Pope Francis. And as God often does, he is ready to surprise us in unexpected ways, for that is how grace works. And so all of us here who shared in this presentation look forward to hearing to your input, your thoughts, and your suggestions. And Your Eminence, on behalf of all of us here, thank you for the opportunity to share these observations about this document.
Thank you.
Thank you, brothers.
Bishop. Thanks. Thanks, Bishop Cajano. Thank you, Archbishop Chaput. As Bishop Cajano has already mentioned, the floor is open to any of you for your comments, suggestions, or questions. Silence in the room.
I don't see.
At this point, Charles, do you have some concluding comments?
One thing needs to be said, a word of thanks to our staff. Once again, you know, our committee is the Committee on Laity, Marriage, Family Life, and Youth. That's a lot of different things. And we have a committee that works very, very hard. The person responsible for kind of organizing our focus on the youth is Paul Zarzembowski, who's up here on the stage with us. I want to especially thank him for his good work. So Paul, stand up. But all of them. Ladies and gentlemen, stand up so we might thank all of you for your good work. Thank you. Thank you, Your Eminence.
Thank you all for, there is a great deal of work that goes into that committee and its ministries. We have another piece of reflection and reporting. Our president-elect, Archbishop Gomez, is going to report on the Working Group for Immigration Issues, and joining him, Bishop Vasquez from Austin. Thank you, Archbishop Gomez.
Thank you, Your Eminence. Bishop Vasquez is coming over there. So, dear Brother Bishops, Bishop Vasquez and I, on behalf of the Working Group of Immigration, are grateful today to present recent immigration updates and invite a dialogue on their implications for all of us, particularly our immigrant brothers and sisters. We'll be concentrating on five items: refugee resettlement, DACA, policies at the southern border. We're supposed to have all that there. TPS and best practices among our dioceses and communities. There are many more topics we could address in the area of migration, but we have narrowed it to this today in the interest of time. Regarding the U.S. Refugee Resettlement and Admission Program, we continue to see drastic cutbacks in the number of refugees this administration is allowing to be admitted into our country. This year, as you can see from the graph, is our lowest year ever, with only 18,000 refugees being welcomed for fiscal year 2020. In previous years, the average number of refugees allowed each year by Republican and Democratic president has been about 95,000. So we understand what is going on here is truly a great reduction in our commitment to refugees. What is concerning is that we are cutting these numbers at a time when the need is greatest. The United Nations says that there are almost 26 million refugees in the world today. On those, the UN says more than 1 million have no other option but to be resettled in another country. Traditionally, the United States has been the largest refugee resettling nation in the world. Our domestic resettlement system is considered a model for public-private partnership. But with these drastic cuts by the administration, we see many domestic programs that resettled refugees are closing. In 2016, there were 325 programs around the country that resettled refugees. As of today, 51 programs have closed permanently, and another 41 programs are set to be closed in the coming months. Our Catholic Charities programs across the country, which have been serving refugees for over 40 years, have also been hurt. 18 programs permanently closed, and 10 more programs in danger of being closed in the coming months. So we remain extremely concerned about this situation and our nation's commitment to providing safety and refugee for those facing life-threatening persecution. Along with the reduction in refugees, we also face an executive order that allows state and city officials to turn away refugees from their communities. This order will create a confusing patchwork across the country, with some places welcoming refugees and others refusing them. This executive order will likely be challenged in court. Now we turn to DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival Programs. Created in 2012, the program currently enables about 700,000 young people to work legally, attend school, and live without the fear of deportation. Today, as we all know, the Supreme Court is holding oral arguments on the DACA cases. The bishops, along with Catholic and ecumenical partners, submitted a friend of the court brief on this issue. In our brief, we argue that the DACA program is needed to protect family unity. We note, for example, that nearly 256,000 children born in the United States have at least one parent with a DACA recipient. We also explain that DACA recipients and the larger Dreamer community are leaders in our parishes, contributors to our economy, and are essentially Americans, but except for the immigration status. We expect an outcome to the DACA case in the late spring 2020. While we support continuing the DACA program, we know it is no substitute for immigration reform. We continue to advocate for Congress to provide a path to citizenship for Dreamers. Only changing the law will give these young people solid protection and security for their families. While we wait for the Supreme Court and Congress to act, there is still a lot we can do to support Dreamers and their families. First, we need to make sure that DACA recipients know their rights and also know the process so they can maintain their DACA status during this time. Accurate legal information is critical, and the church can continue to play an essential role in this effort. Next, we need to keep praying for our Dreamers and their families, as well as the lawmakers and Supreme Court justices. Another way we can help is to organize local efforts to help DACA recipients pay their renewal fees. We can hold open information sessions, and we can connect recipients with attorneys and legal representatives. Finally, we need to continue to accompany the Dreamers and support them with prayer services, listening sessions, and special masses. In terms of policy, the House of Representatives has passed H.R. 6, which includes the DREAM Act. So we need to be urging the Senate to take up the DREAM Act S-874 and to find a solution for Dreamers. And finally, we need to ask Congress to work towards larger legislative reform of our immigration laws. With that, I will now turn the podium to Bishop Vasquez.
Brother Bishops, next we turn to the policies that have been implemented at the U.S.-Mexico border and their implications on human life and dignity. 2019 turned out to be a year with one of the highest volumes of apprehensions at the border. While there certainly have been years with where more people have attempted to come across the U.S. border, the proportion of more vulnerable children and families migrating were unusually high. Our Catholic charities and dioceses have been assisting families at the border by providing humanitarian respite and care, and have been widely recognized for this work. In response to the high number of people arriving, many of them asylum seekers, the current administration issued two policies that have severely limited the ability to claim asylum: the Migration Protection Protocols and the President's Asylum Rule. The Migration Protection Protocols, MPP, known by some as the Remain in Mexico policy, requires that almost all individuals seeking asylum in the United States must wait in Mexico while they have their immigration claim reviewed. While this policy may seem reasonable in theory, the practical impact of the policy is that asylum seekers, including many families, must wait in very dangerous and unsafe conditions for long periods of time in order to exercise their legal rights. For example, in certain sectors of the southern border, they may have to wait for several months for their immigration hearing. During that period, families have little access to decent housing, and there are few lawyers to help them prepare their cases. Another policy of great consequence is the president's asylum rule. This rule prevents people from claiming asylum in the United States if they have traveled through another country, unless they are victims of trafficking or denied asylum in another country. This rule is being challenged through litigation, but the U.S. Supreme Court has allowed it to be implemented while the legal case winds its way through the lower courts. The rule, poorly understood by many asylum seekers, also leaves thousands stranded in Mexico. We are very concerned about the high number of people waiting in Mexico at this time. A particular worry are the families who have mental and physical health disabilities, and pregnant women who should not be subject to these new rules, but are still sometimes forced to wait in dangerous conditions. This contradicts the administration's own policy guidance and does not respect the dignity and the fragility of human life. The human consequences of these policies are immediate and grave. There are drastically lower arrival numbers at the U.S.-Mexico border, with many individuals facing aggressive deterrence or exploitation in Mexico along their journey. There are intense humanitarian needs on the Mexican side of the border, which lacks the infrastructure necessary to address those needs and suffers from civil disorder and the presence of gangs. There are approximately 60,000 people waiting in Mexico, with numbers only increasing as the new policy is further implemented along the U.S.-Mexico border. As I said, these policies are of grave concern. Our brother bishops along the border diocese and I raised these issues with the Department of Homeland Security and offered solutions. I want to note with appreciation the work of the border bishops for addressing this humanitarian crisis. They have worked hard both in their dioceses and in collaboration with the bishops in Mexico to assist on both sides of the border. As a church, we must be attuned to the human suffering wherever we find it. We cannot stop our ministry to those in need simply because they are on one or the other side of the border. I now turn to temporary protective status, or TPS. TPS is a temporary legal permission to work and remain in the United States when a country faces environmental or armed conflict situations that make it unsafe for the people to return to their country. Earlier this month, the administration worked out an agreement with the Salvadoran government by which the administration will extend TPS until January 2021 for holders from El Salvador, Haiti, Nicaragua, Sudan, Honduras, and Nepal. This extension will impact over 330,000 TPS holders. While this is an important development, like DACA, it is temporary and requires a broader legislative fix. We therefore continue to advocate with Congress on a permanent solution. And we are working to ensure that TPS holders know how to keep their status for as long as they may. Brothers, we also have good things to report. We believe it is important to highlight and recognize some of the actions that you and your diocesan institutions and related Catholic groups are doing in order to help immigrants. For instance, the Archdiocese of Baltimore and the Diocese of Dallas and Brownsville are offering parish IDs to immigrant parishioners. The Archdiocese of Washington and Los Angeles are assisting undocumented parents in obtaining passports for their children. The Archdioceses of Indianapolis and San Francisco are developing volunteer networks to accompany migrants to ICE check-ins and court hearings. The Archdiocese of Chicago has a dynamic program designed to equip Hispanic leaders to support one another through service and social justice actions. Catholic Charities of Maine is fostering friendships between local families and asylum seekers. There are other good practices, such as Catholic Community Services of Tucson in connecting parish volunteers to support staff at a hospitality center for asylum-seeking families. Catholic Charities of the Diocese of Jackson is organizing support for families involved in the August 2019 enforcement actions and in helping to assure that those families separated by deportation with U.S. children are supported. They have also testified about recent raids at congressional hearings. The Archdiocese of Miami is training deacons, lay volunteers, and parish groups to minister in detention facilities. We share these examples of our church's work in order to show there are things that we can do and to encourage all of us to do more. Now I turn the podium back to Archbishop Gomez.
Thank you, Bishop Vasquez. Thank you, Brother Bishops, for listening. And now, if it's okay with Cardinal DiNardo, we can open it for dialogue.
Brother Bishops, your questions, comments, recommendations?
All right, who do we see up there?
Archbishop Gutsiak, Boris from Philadelphia, Ukrainians.
I think no community more than Catholics know what it is to be immigrant. I'm grateful to this country which received my parents who had nothing. And this is the story, I think, of every Catholic, virtually every Catholic, in the first, second, third, fourth, fifth generation. I spent 32 years in Europe, and having come back, what you are showing us and what I see and hear in society is a matter of tears. This country was always hospitable. This country needs immigrants for its economy. This tenor of hate that is propagated is something that is really problematic, and it spreads from the U.S. to other countries. It's taken as a model to deal with people on the move. We're patriots. We need to protect borders. Ukraine is bleeding, hemorrhaging because it's protecting its borders. But national borders don't go up to heaven. And first of all, I want to thank the Bishop's Working Group on Immigration. I think we need to be as vociferous and as clear on these issues in the public forum. I think we need to find heroes among our immigrants to show society and those that balk at the truth how rich our legacy is because of people coming to this country. Maybe we can find people to propose for canonization. I don't know his family history well, but at the Knights of Columbus convention, I was profoundly moved by the story of Kendrick Castillo. The name, the beauty of his face show that he's a Latino. I think he's a martyr. maybe this is premature, but I think the church, the Diocese of Denver, would do well to consider opening up his cause for beatification. I'm very proud that we have the Archbishop of Los Angeles, a Latino, as head of our conference. Thank you. And I hope that our conference and the Catholic Church can stand for the poor, those who come to this country with hope, and those who are suffering the most.
Thank you, Archbishop.
Archbishop Wenske, followed by Bishop Seitz.
Well, we do have a heavenly intercessor, because tomorrow we will be celebrating the feast of Mother Cabrini, who was an immigrant and an American citizen and a saint, so we should keep her ask her to pray for us as we face these very serious issues. And DACA is a real serious issue. And we have legislation in the House that was passed. I think it was House Bill 6, right? And House Bill 6 has a solution for DACA and also for TPS recipients. The Senate has not taken it up. And there is a bill now in the Senate, another DREAM Act bill, that if the Senate passed it, then hopefully in conference, the two chambers could work out a unified piece of legislation that would provide that path to citizenship for these people. We came close a little over a year ago when DACA was about to be rescinded, and the administration rescinded DACA, or ordered it rescinded, in order to avoid a lawsuit from about a couple dozen states that were going to sue the government because they felt that administrative order by President Obama was unconstitutional. When it looked like DACA was going to be rescinded permanently, there was a lot of pressure in Congress to provide a solution. And then the law of unintended consequences showed itself, because I think it was the Ninth Circuit, basically put a stay on the rescission, and so DACA continued. But that allowed Congress to kick the can down the road and not provide a solution. The Supreme Court, who knows how they're going to decide, but I think it's a good chance that DACA will fail, or the Supreme Court will agree with the administration. And partly because even when DACA came out, President Obama didn't think it was constitutional until he did. So, and all DACA is a limbo status. Every 2 years, these people have to pay about $500 to extend their limbo status. It doesn't provide them with a path to citizenship. So we really have to recognize that while the Supreme Court might interpret the law, it's Congress that makes the law. And we have to put pressure on our senators to take up the DREAM Act and to get something that the two houses can get together and solve the problem. And they should try to solve it before June, which is when the Supreme Court will probably make its decision, and before June, when the country will be very distracted because of political conventions. So the time to act is really right now.
Thank you, Archbishop. I agree. I think it is important for, it seems to me that two things. One, continue to educate our people on who the DACA young people are, or the ones that are in that situation, that they understand that they are normal, good people. And then also talk to the senators or the elected officials, encouraging them to address the issue, which has been the problem and still. So hopefully we can continue to do that these coming months.
Bishop Seitz, followed by Bishop Cousins.
I'd very much like to thank the committee for your very important work. I think in so many ways, these issues surrounding immigration are a battle for the soul of our country, right along with the abortion issues that we've been dealing with for a long time. I'd like to just make two very brief points. I'll try to make them as briefly as I can. First of all, Bishop Vasquez alluded to the problem that is now facing us. It's using a phrase we've used before, a true humanitarian crisis on the other side of the border. Tens of thousands of people stuck there with no place to go. They've sold everything. They've taken out loans, and they have fled their home countries. They cannot go back without facing serious consequences, and they can't go forward. No resources. We cannot, as the church that has the name Universal, turn our eyes from this crisis right at the door of our country. Many people in our nation seem to have looked in other directions once they ceased crossing in such numbers, but we can't allow that to happen. And so I'd ask you to be conscious of this need and do what you can to support any efforts to assist those people that are left there in this limbo. Secondly, you all are aware that on August 3rd in El Paso, we had another of our nation's mass shootings. 22 people were killed, 26 people were injured. And what added to the horror of that event is that a man, a young man, saw it as his duty to travel nearly 700 miles to El Paso in order to kill as many people of Hispanic heritage, of Mexican heritage, as many immigrants as he possibly could. I think it reveals that at least as a significant element, and certainly not the only reason that people would call for a limitation of immigration, but a significant element in this mix is a rising racism in our country. What has been referred to in the past by Archbishop Chaput as the original sin of our country is still present among us, and it expressed itself on that day. And we also, as a church, need to respond to that ongoing threat. Thank you.
Thank you, Bishop Seitz. Thank you.
They don't have, okay. Bishop Cousins, followed by Bishop Soto.
Just want to add my own words of gratitude to the work of the committee and offer one suggestion, which is we all know that one of the great challenges we have, at least in many of our parishes, is to educate our own people on the gravity of this issue, and that many of our own people don't understand it. One of the ways we found some success in the Archdiocese of St. Paul, Minneapolis, is we've been taking some of our DACA youth on tour in our suburban parishes where we think that people wouldn't understand what we're doing. And I have gone there, I'll celebrate a mass, I'll preach a homily, and I'll invite the people of the parish to come to a session afterwards where we simply have our DACA youth tell their story. How is it that they came here? What are they doing here now? And they're difficult stories often to listen to, but we found it helpful to have that moment of encounter with people who might disagree with the church's teaching on immigration as a way to try to influence them.
Thank you, Bishop Cousins.
Bishop Soto, followed by Bishop Habash.
My thanks to the good work of the Bishops Working Group on Immigration, and just wanted to highlight that we just celebrated Veterans Day, and that among the veterans, there's a significant number of immigrants and children of immigrants who have made the supreme sacrifice and are serving their country, and that the policies of the administration are a betrayal of the ideals and the sacrifices that these men and women have made and that their families have made.
Thank you, Bishop Soto.
Bishop Habash, followed by Cardinal O'Malley.
I believe strongly that there is no any problem with the borders of America. I wish I could extend my voice to American administrations and to say the borders of America, nobody can hurt these borders, not military, not economically, not socially, not any level. But on the opposite, the gates of America, the borders of America are the gates of the good. Most of the people came to America are blessing for America. They share in the wealth of America. They share in building of America. So I wish to extend this voice to administration to say open widely the gates of America, but to protect America is to protect the rules of America, the political mind of America, the political leadership of America, not to opposite each other. The Democrats opposite the Republican and vice versa. Here is the problem of America, and thus reflects on wonderful society and the most generous society in the world, most generous nationality or country or nation in the world. This is the problem of America. To look at America as nation of immigrants, and if we close the gates of America and from the other, we are committing mortal sin against this wonderful nation. But there is people, they hurt America, they hate America, and they are very, very openly welcome to America under many political reasons or by very undercover reasons as well. This is my chagrin in my heart when I heard the gates of America are closed in front of everybody. But we should be careful. Those they are in America, they should be not hypocrites with their own sick doctrine. The doctrine that doesn't believe in America, they are hypocrites, and they do make a pledge to American flag by hypocrisy. Thank you.
Cardinal O'Malley?
I know that sometimes our advocacy on behalf of immigrants is seen as self-serving because so many of the immigrants are Catholics. I think it's important for us to stress that this is a human rights issue. I was very encouraged recently when we were approached in Boston by leaders of the Jewish community there who said, when we hear about borders being closed, it makes us very uncomfortable. And they said, we don't have direct services like you do, but we want to help you. And they went out and raised almost $1 million for Catholic Charities to hire more immigration lawyers. I think as a church, we need to be working closely with other church groups and the interfaith community to be able to address this most serious human problem that we're facing in immigration.
Thank you, Your Eminence.
Bishop Dolan.
A few years ago, Pope Francis called for the wonderful campaign called Share the Journey. It was a two-year campaign, and we know that in some ways that has come to an end, but I encourage you to continue that and to share the journey, share the stories. Some of you have already talked about that, about how it's important for us as bishops to educate the people, but we ourselves need to be educated and share the journey. Listen to the stories of the wonderful men and women who have come into this country legally, illegally, through DACA or otherwise. And listen to what they have to say. I had the joy of doing that myself during the campaign, and I interviewed a number of people, many of whom are right within our curia in the Diocese of San Diego. And I had a chance to listen to people from the Philippines, from Indonesia, from Vietnam, from Colombia, from Mexico, and from other parts of our world. And as I listened to them, I then asked them two questions. The first question was, what gift do you bring to this country? And they said, the gift of family. Family. We've all heard that before, that family is so important to them. And that enriches our country. Someone spoke about how we are enriched economically, but we are enriched with the gift of family. And we've been focusing on family as such an important part of this body. But then I also asked them the question, and what gift does America offer you? And they said, freedom. And I asked them to tell me, what does that mean to you? And they said, freedom of expression. They're able to express themselves without fear, without fear. I think that's a very important thing for us to hear. And it does add to this nation, because I think in many ways, many of us have this a different understanding of freedom. Freedom means to be, running off on our own, doing our own thing, being our own island. And there's so much more to freedom. And I think our immigrant brothers and sisters can share with us what that really means.
Thank you, Bishop Dolan.
Archbishop Broglio.
Dovetailing on something that Bishop Soto said and also that Cardinal O'Malley said, 12 years ago when I was asked to take over the Archdiocese for the military services, the Sostituto made the point that one-third of the U.S. military was Spanish-speaking, and they thought it would be a good idea to have a pastor who spoke Spanish. I can only imagine, although I don't have any statistics in that regard, that the percentage is higher at this point. So in a certain sense, the immigrant population is serving our country. It's one of the fastest ways to become a citizen. And so if it is self-serving, it's serving the whole nation. Thank you.
Thank you, Archbishop. Just one thing that I was thinking of when Bishop Sides was talking about the humanitarian crisis. I think tomorrow CRS and Clinic are making presentations, and I think they are helping, especially on that specific situation. So hopefully we can hear from them tomorrow. So thank you very much to you all.
Archbishop Gomez, Bishop Vasquez, thank you for your presentation and for the work that is done. Archbishop has done yeoman's work in the leadership in this mixture of people we use in committees for the immigration material. I would only have one comment to this. We should always be alert that we can say something to politicians in Congress, whether it's state Congress or federal, while at the same time maintaining this. My history over the last 3 years of dealing with politicians is is not something I would want to emulate. It's you're dealing with people who will look you in the face at 12 noon and say one thing, and at 4:45 in the afternoon do something totally different, and you still have to maintain some kind of relationship with them. And it gets very frustrating, but I think if we don't do it, we are a force to be reckoned with in the church, and I think that's important when we deal with the immigration issues. We are at the end of our meeting for today, and Monsignor, you have some announcements.
Thank you, Your Eminence. Eminences, Excellencies, tomorrow morning there will be a meeting of the Metropolitan Archbishops and Senior Suffragans from 8:30 to 9:15 a.m. Documentation for this meeting was emailed to you, and we'll have additional copies if needed. That meeting will be held here in this General Assembly room, so the meeting will be closed for anything else during that period of time. Then regional meetings begin at 9:30 and proceed until 10:45 tomorrow morning, and we will reconvene in general session at 11 a.m. tomorrow morning. Please leave your voting pads here on the table. They will be collected this evening. Thank you, Eminence.
With that, we are, I'm sorry. With that, we are adjourned till tomorrow. And as always, at the end of the day, we say the doxology. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. Our Lady of Guadalupe, pray for us. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.